Welcome to the Shrine of Remembrance podcast series, recorded live at our talks and events. We're ending our 2018 podcasting series with Dr. Jean Beau speaking about the capture of Damascus in 1918. Don't worry, we will be continuing to release podcasts throughout the summer, so make sure to stay tuned. Jean is a lecturer in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. He has published extensively on the Light Horse and the Australian Imperial Forces Sinai-Palestine campaign. And for now, it's over to Jean.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Now, when I do these things, there's always the issue, well, do I prepare a script or do I not prepare a script? And last week I went to a presentation in Canberra where there was a prepared script and it was given by an academic rather like myself, and it got very dense and pretty dull, I have to say. So having started on a script, I tore it up, and I'm just going to talk today off the cuff. It's normally the way I lecture at university, and well, if I don't know this topic by now, well, I deserve to crash and burn here anyway. I'm kind of a bit tired of the lecture. I do have a microphone here, but it's this kind, which I might feel a bit self-conscious using. But that's the way it's going to work today. The biggest issue is time. Lee over there has promised to stand up and wave at me at around about the 35-minute mark. I would like, we have an unveiling, and I would like to leave some time for some question and answers. So with time of the essence, let's crack on. And of course, today I'm talking about the Battle of Megiddo, the seizing of Damascus, and what went on afterwards. Of course, I'm going to outline the events themselves, both before and after. But what I'm really going to try and focus on a bit today is context. As a military historian, when I'm teaching people, we bang on at length about understanding history in depth and breadth. Context is everything. And only by understanding the context can you understand what the events here kind of mean, and in the broader sense of the war. And there is certainly a tendency, not just in Australia and other places, they have their own tendency towards the same end of focusing very much on the Australian aspect. Yes, I am going to talk about the Light Horse today, but I'm going to talk about the Light Horse within the context of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, within the context of the Palestine campaign, within the context of the wider war, with some boundaries. I'm not going to sit here and talk about American industrial output, I won't say excuse the context, but that's part of what's going to be, today is going to be about. All right, so in that vein, let's have a look at the ground that we're going to talk about today. Hopefully all of you know that this event took place in Palestine and then into what is now Syria and Lebanon as well. If you look at the broader map there of the Middle East, that's Palestine there, which of course is essentially modern Israel, going into Lebanon and then Syria up here around Damascus. From the Ottoman point of view, Lebanon and Syria are pretty much the same piece of territory. They're not the delineated areas, of course, nation states that they are today. If looking at this map here, which gives a little bit more detail of northern Palestine, you can see the lay of the land. On the coast, there's a port here called Jaffa, which is essentially subsumed into modern Tel Aviv, so it is where Tel Aviv is today. And of course, you have Jerusalem there. That's the Jordan Valley here and the Jordan River. The Sea of Galilee, otherwise known as Lake Tiberias. To the east of the Jordan, you've got some pretty rugged terrain. Quite mountainous, not very well developed. There are railway lines. You see, the Ottomans have built a railway line down there, and there are railway lines that come into Palestine as well. To the west of the Jordan River, there's also a chain of hills here, some of which is quite rugged in places, but it's not quite so high or difficult as the terrain east of the Jordan River. And as you get to the coast here, of course, you get into the coastal plain. And this little, I'd hesitate to call it a mountain ridge, but it's certainly a ridge that runs up there towards Haifa. What's important on the coast are places like Jaffa, Haifa, and a few other places further north, which are ports. And they are, who owns those ports matters for what goes on in Megiddo, because it's about getting supplies in. A lot of what supports the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, the EEF, is actually coming by railway line from Egypt, but a certain amount of it is coming in from the Mediterranean. The problem is, most of these ports are very small, not very well developed. Jaffa is a port, but it's the Thames estuary, it ain't. It is a very small port with limited capacities, and the ports north are not substantially different in that regard. All right, so we get an idea of what the terrain looks like. What about the armies that are fighting on it? All right, the Ottoman army, by 1918, is an army that is starting to look a little bit ropey. It's had a difficult war. Everyone's had a difficult war. But the Ottoman state is not as resilient or doesn't have as deep a pockets and doesn't have industrial capacity behind it in the way that many of the other belligerents do. So by 1918, it's starting to have considerable problems maintaining its war effort. It's also worth bearing in mind that in 1918, its major strategic focus, even though Palestine is part of its territory, as is Mesopotamia, its main strategic focus is actually on the Caucasus, because Russia has been knocked out of the war, and there's a bit of a scrap going on between the Germans, the Austrians, and anybody else about who's going to get to control, particularly the oil resources around Baku and in the Caucasus. And in fact, at one point, the Germans and the Ottomans actually start shooting at each other around Baku. Allies are great, aren't they? So there's still a large number of Ottoman troops in Palestine, but the amount of material support they've got, which has never been high, is relatively low. Ottoman administrative systems are not that great. Their health system is not that good. So they have a lot of soldiers who are sick all the time. So on paper, their strength is roughly equivalent to the British and Allied forces opposed to them, but that is a number that's got a certain amount of hollowness to it. The British, on the other hand, by 1918 are at the peak of their game, if you like. The EEF is affected by a few things which I'll come back to, but by 1918 the British Empire is at full flight. Its industrial production is completely ramped up to support the war. The British armies, like everybody else apart from the Americans who've just joined, have got manpower issues, but nonetheless, the EEF of 1918, it's got a lot of battle experience behind it. It has a massive amount of material resources. It has the breadbasket, if you like, of Egypt behind it. The EEF is in a very good position to be able to conduct offensive operations. So these are the two armies that are in opposition at the time. The Ottoman army is commanded by Lehman von Sanders, the same commander who commanded at Gallipoli. The problem for the Ottomans is that one of the problems with Sanders is there's always a bit of tension between the German officers and the Ottoman officers. Sanders has also not been kept up to date with the developments in the war. He spent most of the war out in the Ottoman Empire. So all the tactical developments have been going on the Western Front and the Eastern Front and other places. He's not abreast of. So the Ottoman army in Palestine is set up using a defensive scheme which is old and is going to prove to be very brittle. Conversely, the British commander is Edmund Allenby. He's had a mixed career on the Western Front, but he's come to Palestine. He's done really well. I kind of get the sense with Allenby, he arrives in the Middle East and the guy just relaxes. He doesn't have Haig looking over his shoulder, who he didn't get along with terribly well personally. He doesn't have Haig looking over his shoulder. You know, of course, things on the Western Front are pretty high tempo. When he comes out to Egypt, whilst he thought it was actually a demotion, the sense I've got is that the guy just relaxed and actually started to get into being his own person, if you want. And he gets to run his own campaign out here. All right, so talking about context, the war in 1918, what's going on in other places? Okay, the Western Front. The Western Front has become the cockpit of the war. It wasn't always, that was not preordained in any way, but by 1917, of course, the Russians are knocked out of the war, the Eastern Front is shut down. So whilst there are other fronts, and I'm going to talk about those in a moment, and they are significant in their own ways, what matters is what happens. This is where the war is going to be won or lost to a large extent, certainly where the Entente can lose it, and certainly where the Germans are going to need to be beaten in order to win the war. Now, what happens in early, if everyone is expecting in 1918, is a massive German offensive, and the German spring offensives fulfill that prophecy. It's not much of a prophecy. Anyone could see it. It was going to come. And the German spring offensives are unleashed in March. They are quite successful in some ways. They certainly create crises, at least two crises for the British Expeditionary Force and one crisis for the French. But they peter out. The powerful, rich, highly industrialised nation states that are fighting on the Western Front with highly developed railway and logistic networks behind them are incredibly difficult beasts to kill. And the Germans do not have the capacity or indeed the tactical toolbox to be able to beat the opponents that they are facing. By 1918, the British and the French are very resilient. The French have... People tend to ignore the French. I continue to be astounded by the amount that we ignore the French on the Western Front. The French are the mainstay of what's going on the Western Front. And of course, in 1918, what's also happening is the Americans are starting to arrive in numbers. Their troops are mostly untrained. Their formations are pretty patchy. Some of them get quite good quite quickly. But nonetheless, if the war goes into 1919, as everybody's expecting, the Americans are going to play a big role. And there's going to be so many of them. And that, of course, is what drives the Germans on to launching offensives. It's to try and knock the British and the French out before the Americans arrive. Because once the Americans arrive, the numerical calculus is going to be even more against Germany. Now, the German offensives peter out. And they peter out in the summer. The last two or three offensives aren't terribly successful. And the last attempt is on the 15th of July, which the French blunt very quickly. And indeed, 2 days later, the French launch a massive counterattack at what becomes known as the Second Battle of the Marne, which wipes out the major German advance from earlier in the year. And this, as much as we bang on in Australia about the 100 days and the 8th of August, the 18th of July is the turning point in 1918 on the Western Front. And from that moment on, the Germans know that they are stuffed. They're going to have to find some sort of solution. And once the 100 days starts in August, that's just, as it were, that the major offensives that are going to have to take place to defeat the Germans. So that's the context of what's going on outside of that. What also matters is what's going on in Italy. The Italians have had a major defeat at the end of 1917 at the Battle of Caporetto. Nonetheless, they've held the Austrians, and they're looking at going on the offensive again in 1918. The offensive is not going to take place until after Megiddo, actually, but it's going to be astoundingly successful, and that's going to matter for what happens at the end of the war. And what also, people also tend to forget is Salonika. That's northern Greece. You can see there, Serbia, Montenegro, Bulgaria. This theatre gets completely forgotten about because for 3 years, essentially, the front line doesn't move at all. But at the end of 1918, this front breaks open in a big way. And it actually has a pretty important outcome on the way that the war comes to an end. So I will come back to that. All right, so what does Palestine look like? Well, there's the map that I used before. And that's pretty much where the front line is in the period that we're talking about in 1918. At the end of 1917, the front line comes to a rest here just north of Jaffa and just here around about Jerusalem. In early 1918, the EEF pushes down, captures Jericho, and its right flank is now resting on the Jordan River. In March, Allenby attempts a raid at Amman to blow up the railway viaduct there and generally make life a bit unpleasant for the Ottomans. It fails. It's followed up in April by what we generally know as the Assault Raid. This is another failure. What Allenby was actually trying to achieve with this is actually something of a moot point. No one's entirely sure. In the aftermath, it was called a raid, and that's basically a way to cover up the fact it's a failure. Okay. Spin is nothing new. Both of these Transjordan operations, they're Allenby's low point in this campaign, if you like. His judgment was not what it was, particularly the Assault one. This is a moment where he kind of has a go. The objectives are a little bit unclear, at least to everybody else apart from maybe him, and it doesn't. Neither of them come off. Now, in July, there's a little bit of fighting around the bridgeheads across the Jordan River, where the Ottomans try to kick the British forces out of the bridgeheads. The Light Horse are involved in some of these fights, as are British and Indian troops as well. This is the last time in the theatre that the Ottoman army will attempt an offensive. And in fact, German commanders, Sanders, looks at how the Ottoman army performs in this offensive and basically comes to the conclusion that his army is no longer fit for offensive operations. It is not capable of pulling it off anymore. The Ottoman army is becoming weaker and less competent. Now, what is going on, we come back to the context again, what's going on while these raids are taking place is that the war on the Western Front, this is when the German spring offensives unfold. And they kick off at virtually the same time as the Amman raid. And what this leads to is the EEF fulfilling its strategic role of being a strategic reserve. Allenby loses a large part of his army, particularly his British troops. Those guys find themselves marching to the coast, jumping on ships, heading across the Mediterranean, and being redeployed in France. It means that the EEF is, to a large extent, gutted. What he has left is his Australian troops, his New Zealand troops, his Indian troops. They've left enough British troops in here to act as a cadre for an expansion, but he's going to have to rebuild. So he's got, as I said, he's got his Australians, there's an Australian Light Horse, there's some Australian and British troops in Aissalt during the Aissalt raid. But the EEF now transforms. It's no longer, the EEF is always an imperial army. It's probably the most imperial army of the war from the British perspective. It's got Indians, Australians, New Zealanders, British, well, English, Scots, Welsh. I don't think, there's probably some Irish somewhere, but I don't know for sure. But now it becomes even more imperial, more in polyglot. And in fact, by this stage, the EEF in 1918 effectively becomes largely an Indian army. It is heavily Indianised. So the troops, most of the troops you see in the EEF in 1918 look like this. They're not Australian, as much as a lot of the stuff in Australia would have you believe that Light Horse win the war by themselves. Actually, a lot of the war is won by guys who look like this. That's not to say the Australians aren't important, but even in the Desert Mounted Corps, the Australians are the largest single national component, but only by one regiment. There are nearly as many Indian regiments in the Desert Mounted Corps in 1918. Now, the Indian cavalry in the Desert Mounted Corps is very good. The Indian infantry, a lot of it is not, because they are mostly newly recruited soldiers. So Allenby spends a lot of 1918 retraining the EEF, getting it ready to a point where it can conduct operations again. So as time marches on, both in this lecture and in history, Allenby comes up with a plan. Now, earlier in the year, he'd attempted a cavalry encirclement. In the previous year, he attempted a cavalry encirclement at Beersheba and in southern Palestine, trying to get around behind Gaza. That had not worked. But he's going to try a similar scheme for what we now know as the Megiddo Offensive. But instead of trying to break through on the inland flank, he's going to break through on the coast. Now, opposing him, he's got three Ottoman armies, the 4th, the 7th, and the 8th. Allenby's got three corps at his disposal. Two infantry corps, which we tend to overlook completely here in Australia, which are mostly Indian, Indian and British. That's 20 corps and 21 corps, and he's got the Desert Mounted Corps under Harry Chevelle, the first Australian to become a Lieutenant General and a corps commander, beating Monash to both accolades at least by a year. And Chevelle's going to has done quite well up to this point, and he's going to do quite well in this offensive as well. So the idea is he's going to concentrate his forces here on the coast and with 21 corps, and in reserve behind it is going to be most of the Desert Mounted Corps. By this stage, the Desert Mounted Corps has got four cavalry divisions, including the Australian Mounted and the Anzac Mounted Division. Yes, Australian Light Horse are a form of cavalry, and in fact, at this point, the Australian Light Horse and the Australian Mounted Division equips with the sword and will undertake this offensive as full sword-wielding cavalry in the British Army mould. The Anzac Mounted Division don't do that. And they grumble because they get given the job of, under New Zealander Chater, of conducting subsidiary operations over here. And they grumble about that because they think they've been penalised for not being equipped with the sword. Anyway, so Desert Mounted Corps, 4th and 5th Cavalry Division, Australian Mounted Division, under Chevelle, concentrated here in the orange groves behind. It's part of the idea of this is that all this is done in secrecy, that the German airmen had never got across. That's been in the histories for nearly 100 years. We now know that the Germans, Ottomans, actually did have a fairly good idea of what was coming. They didn't know when it was coming, and the reality is they probably just couldn't do much about it. But they had a fair idea of what they were in store for. So on the morning of the 19th of September, concentrated artillery here opens up with a Western Front-style barrage. By 1918, it's not days and days of preparatory fire, in the same way that it's done at Villers-Bretonneux, at Amiens, a whole bunch of other places on the Western Front in this period. The registrations are hidden, silent registrations. Gunfire opens up basically just before H hour. Creeping barrage quickly kicks in. The infantry up, they go, and they follow the creeping barrage. There's some pretty stiff fighting in a few places, but pretty much the line is cracked open by about 8 o'clock in the morning. And this is where the Ottoman failure in the defensive lines, because the Ottomans under Sanders have not adopted the latest defence and depth system that has been used by the Germans on the Western Front. They've got a traditional sort of first line of trenches, second line of trenches, and then they've got some spitlock trenches in third. And British tactics by 1918 can just absolutely roll over those, and that's what they do. So what happens very quickly is there's a massive gap here on the coast. 4th and 5th Cavalry Division are leading. They have staff officers in infantry headquarters so that they know as soon as the way is clear, they can be called forward and they go for it. 5th Cavalry Division on the left is literally going up the beach. Well, it's part of 5th Cavalry Division's literally going up the beach. Australian Mounted Division is in reserve. 5th Mounted is headed for 5th Cavalry is headed for Nazareth, and 4th is headed here ultimately for Bizan. And the idea is to strike deep and cut in behind the Ottoman troops that are here in northern Palestine and basically catch them in a big sack. It is a classic encirclement. The German army would have loved this. This is a classic encirclement. Grab them into a kessel, into a cauldron, and then destroy them. And that's what happens. And within a few days, 5th Division has hit Nazareth within about 24 hours. Similarly, 4th is reaching up Bizan. The Australian Mounted Division has followed them through the Musmus Pass here, which is on that ridge that I pointed to before. And then they go down and they capture Jenin. Chaita Force, which is operating here, has captured some of the crossings across the Jordan. 21 Corps, of course, is swinging this way towards Nablus. 20 Corps pushing out this way. And effectively, the 7th and the 8th Ottoman armies disappear. They no longer exist as combat-viable formations. A few of them do escape across the Jordan River, but not as organised bodies of troops. It's a real mess. The Ottomans have been utterly annihilated in northern Palestine. 4th Army out here to the east of the Jordan takes one look at its exposed flank. It says, we're out of here, and they're headed for Damascus as quickly as possible. So that gives a map here that gives you a good outline of all these movements. 5th Cavalry Division having taken Nazareth, which is where von Sanders has his headquarters, and he literally escapes from his headquarters in his car in his pyjamas. He's on the road, which means that he's out of touch with his troops. He has difficulty re-establishing communications with his army because he's on the run. 5th Cavalry then pushes up and they capture Haifa quite quickly. As I said, 4th Cavalry Division pushes on and captures Bizan. And that all happens within a few days. The offensive has begun on the 19th of September. All of that has been achieved more or less by about the 25th of September, which is about when you can effectively say the Megiddo Offensive, as it was, comes to an end. The last shot, if you like, of the Megiddo Offensive is when the Australians get pushed up from Nablus up to it to take Samak, which is probably the stiffest fight the Australians take part in, the Battle of Samak, right at the tip there of the Sea of Galilee, and also takes Tiberias. At this point, the EEF pauses quite briefly. Allenby and confers with Chevelle, and Allenby's quite keen to push on to Damascus, and as is Chevelle, because they know the way is open, they can keep going. The ultimate strategic objective is Aleppo, because Aleppo is the railway junction where the railway comes out of Anatolia and splits. One line comes down here into Palestine and Arabia, the other line goes down into Mesopotamia. If you take Aleppo, you've taken that railway junction. The Ottomans, aside from the fact you've knocked the Ottomans out in Palestine, you've also knocked them out in Mesopotamia. So that's the ultimate objective, is Aleppo. Mass Ottoman surrenders. These guys have a pretty unpleasant time of it. A lot of them are in very poor health when they're captured. The British actually get fairly overwhelmed by the number of POWs they take, and a lot of these guys actually die in this period because of their poor health condition and the fact the British are just overwhelmed and they can't establish the camps and the health services quickly enough. Of course, the airmen are ranging over this all the time, attacking retreating Ottoman troops, and that's Australian troops. They're debouching from the Musmus Pass, which is at El Lejeune, which is around about here, Megiddo, El Lejeune, and that's the Nablus Plain there in front of them. And if you've ever get a chance to visit the place, you can stand up on top of Tel Megiddo, and all you see, the plain to the north and the east is just flat as a tack. And you can see when the cavalry gets out of the pass and onto that plain, they just can go anywhere they want as fast as they want. And it's part of the reason why they overrun the Ottomans so quickly. All right, so now that they've essentially destroyed two Ottoman armies in northern Palestine, the third one is running for its life and trying to get to Damascus, and it's being harassed the whole way by the Arab Northern Army. So those guys with Lawrence of Arabia, they get involved in the campaign as well and make life very difficult. Pushing on to Damascus, Australian Mounted Division is about here, it then pushes to the north of the Sea of Galilee and then drives in on Damascus from the north, from the southwest. 5th Cavalry Division is following it, and the 4th Cavalry Division crosses the Jordan, captures Deraa, and then drives on Damascus from the south, pretty much from the south, with the Arab Northern Army bouncing around along the flank. Australians fight a whole bunch of skirmishes on the way to Damascus. Perhaps the best one known one is one at Kalkub, but there's a couple of others. And then they get to Damascus proper. They trap a whole bunch of troops in the Barada Gorge and a fair bit of bloodshed at the Barada Gorge. And then they're the first troops into Damascus. Yes, there's supposedly an argument about who got to Damascus first. There isn't really an argument because the Australians were there first, for what it's worth. The 4th Ottoman Army is caught just short of Damascus. The Australians might have got to Damascus first, but everyone else is hot on their heels. 4th Cavalry Division, you know, when the Australians get into Damascus, 4th Cavalry Division's probably about there. And in fact, the 4th Ottoman Army is captured here, well, caught just short of Damascus. Some of it, I think, staggers into Damascus and then beyond, but by and large, 4th Ottoman Army ceases to exist as well. Now, whilst all this is going on, the people we completely forget about in Australia, yes, the poor bloody infantry are doing the stuff up the coast. And this is really vitally important because, as I mentioned before, it's the ports. So there's British Indian infantry divisions making their way up the coast, taking Acre, taking Beirut, and then ultimately pushing onwards. And it means that as this advance is dashing forward on the inland route here, that the ports are being opened and you're getting lateral transportation routes that can bring in the resources. And all the Desert Mounted Corps advance is underpinned by motorised transport. And in fact, if you go to War Memorial, there's actually a little pamphlet written by the chief logistics officer in Desert Mounted Corps. He was clearly very proud of what he had done and what his troops had done. And it sets out exactly what the logistic effort was that kept the Desert Mounted Corps on the road. And the Australians are mostly held around Damascus, and the British cavalry divisions are pushed north. I think 5th is leading, 4th is following up. They take Homs, and then they get to Aleppo right at the end of October, where they finally meet an Ottoman rear guard. They take Aleppo, which is the objective, and they fight just beyond the town. They finally meet an Ottoman rear guard they can't beat, because the Ottomans have finally gathered themselves. And by this stage, a desert mounted corps is completely shattered. You know, they've been, this has been an advance 500 kilometres as far as the crow flies. The horses are tired, the men are tired, they're strung out along this road. You know, 4th and 5th Cavalry Division are up this way. The Australians are being called for. The Australians actually finished the war at Homs. And what's also hitting the EEF at this point is malaria, and in the influenza pandemic is starting to come through. And the malaria rates in Desert Mounted Corps, and indeed the EEF at this point of the war, are as high as the malaria rates suffered by Australia in the Southwest Pacific in the Second World War. So malaria is a big problem. And lots of soldiers die, and because it's the malaria, because it's a combination of malaria and influenza, they actually don't know what they're dying of. One of the two. So the EEF by this stage is pretty stuffed, and of course it's starting to come into winter. The weather's starting to change, and at this point, the Ottomans are called for an armistice because of other things that are happening in the war. Wrap it up now with a few minutes to go, leave enough time for the bust and what have you. This is where the other theatres matter. As much as the Ottomans have been completely put on their heels by a crisis in Palestine, an even bigger crisis is besetting them in the Balkans. Because that little old Salonika front, which everyone kind of ignores, around about the same time, a little bit after the breakout at Megiddo, there's a big offensive takes place on the Salonika front. And the Bulgarians collapse. The Bulgarians are the land bridge between Germany, Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire. The Bulgarian army is at the end of its tether. The Bulgarian state is at the end of its tether. And when the British, French, Greek, Serbian armies go through them in the offensive at Salonika, the army comes apart and the Bulgarian government says, OK, that's it, the war's over for us. This takes out the land bridge. But what more importantly, what it does is that as the Allied armies come out of Salonika, they advance, and they advance very quickly. The French and Serbian armies go rampaging through the Balkans, and within a couple of weeks, they're on the Austro-Hungarian frontier from the southeast. A French army is on the verge of crossing the Danube River when the Austro-Hungarians finally pull the pin and say, we're out of the war as well. The British and Greek armies... So the French and the Serbians have turned left and driven northwards. The British and Greek armies come out of Salonika. They turn right. And what's to the right? Constantinople. And what's between them and Constantinople? In short, nothing. The Ottomans have no serious troop concentrations on that front. They have been relying on the Bulgarians. So you combine the problems that they're having in Palestine... And this tie in, the British also starting to do a bit of stuff in Mesopotamia. Combine it with the crisis in the Balkans, it's over for the Ottoman Empire as well. And they're seeking an armistice. So Megiddo is it's an amazing operational operation, worth studying in itself. But the context of what's going on in the wider war is what gives its importance. And of course... What's also matters now is that the balance of power in the Middle East has dramatically changed. The Ottoman Empire, which has been controlling this part of the world for centuries, no longer exists. There's now the question of who gets to control this territory after the war. The British are going to come out with most of it. The French will take a bit. The Arabs are going to get stuffed. You can point at more recent history and what happens in the aftermath of the war and... draw lines, perhaps validly, sometimes not always validly, but that's part of the history that we inherit today. And that's dead on 40 minutes, so I will stop there. Which should allow some time for Q&A.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sean, for the presentation. Lee has a microphone, and Sean is happy to take questions from the floor. So if you'd just like to raise your hand, Lee will bring the microphone to you, and then you can ask your question. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. That was great. You were talking before about the cavalry role that some of the Australian regiments had. I don't believe there were any lancers among the Australians, but did any of those Indian regiments, were they armed with lances and that sort of more traditional, you know, cavalry weaponry?
Yeah, certainly. There were quite a few Indian regiments that were lancer regiments. None of the British regiments were, because they were all yeomanry and they were equipped with a sword, not the lance. Certainly none of the Australians were equipped with a lance. There wasn't much in actual usage by the First World War. When I talk about the cavalry role, you shouldn't get this sort of mental picture of serried ranks of horsemen charging across to glorious death and all the rest of it. Cavalry tactics, British cavalry tactics of the First World War, are entirely appropriate, entirely competent, and in Palestine they work time and time again. And in fact, if you read the Australian accounts of what using the sword in this part of the campaign, they say, look, you know, there's a certain amount of risk in it, but, you know, plenty of infantry attacks fail too, and not many cavalry ones do, certainly in this campaign. The Australians make the comment that when they had fought in southern Palestine in 1917, after Beersheba and on the drive into central Palestine, time and time again they came up against large groups of enemy withdrawing, and they couldn't do anything about them except dismount and shoot at them. Getting around them was really difficult, but and this is where they feel the lack of the sword, and they flip that over in 1918 because now they have the sword. And in the exploitation phase particularly, because the enemy is demoralised and they're strung out on the road, you can take the risks and charging in with a sword, and they say, and it really does make things quicker and actually less costly than dismounting and doing a dismounted attack. Yeah. And when they're doing don't think of it as a cavalry charge. The best way to think of it is as a mounted attack. They're still doing reconnaissance. They're still using the ground for cover. They're still using fire support, whether it's in the form of machine guns or horse artillery. It's a mounted attack. And the Australians do quite a lot of it. Well, the Australian Mounted Division does quite a lot of it in this part of the war. Yeah.
But those Indian lancers are obviously highly trained troops then to be able to, if they are going in, running down,
yep,
fleeing Turks, they're obviously well.
All the Indian cavalry are regulars.
Yeah.
And in fact, Allenby, at the beginning of 1918, all the Indian cavalry divisions that have been on the Western Front come to Palestine. I won't say why, because it's a bit of an involved story. But so almost all the Indian cavalry, in fact, all the Indian cavalry are pre-war regulars. They're good troops.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Up the back.
Thank you.
Just wait, please.
So you alluded before to the fact that the Australians were all around Damascus. Do you actually subscribe to the theory that the surrender was taken by an Australian officer hours before Lawrence arrived?
I don't know if I'll be honest, it's been a while since I've gone into this. I can't remember if there was an Australian officer. I recall the story, one of the, I think it's Olden maybe, commanding 10th Light Horse. Yeah, a 10th Light Horse is the first one through Damascus. I don't think there's much debate about that. It's 3rd Light Horse Brigade. 10th Light Horse happened to be leading the push at that point because they couldn't get around town. I think someone tried to surrender to Olden, and Olden sort of went, yeah, whatever, I've got things to do. it was kind of, I think it's more in that vibe. You want to surrender to me? Yeah, sure, thanks. I've got, by the way, A Squadron, can you go over there? Sort of thing. People like to get wrapped around the axles a bit about this kind of stuff. And in one sense, I can understand that, but this is the First World War. You got millions of people doing all sorts of stuff every day, thousands of people dying every day. Who's first into Damascus? I'm sorry, I can't care very much.
Perspective.
Yeah.
Excellent. Are there any other further questions? Yes.
John, thanks very much for your lecture. With the change in the composition of the Egyptian expedition before. Did the command structures also change in what way?
Yes and no. There wasn't much change at the top. I mean, Allenby remained in command. Desert Chevelle stayed with command of Desert Mounted Corps, and Shea and Chetwood stayed in command of the infantry corps. There were certainly changes below that as the divisions and when the Indian troops arrive, Indian cavalry troopers arrive from Western Front, they basically arrive as regiments. And the habit in the British Indian Army is that you brigade white British troops with Indian troops. So you have two Indian regiments and one white regiment, and that creates a cavalry brigade. So they do the same thing in Palestine. So they're creating new brigades and to put together the division. So there are certainly are changes at lower level, yeah. Is that what you're looking for?
Yep.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Please join me in thanking John Bowe.
Thank you for listening to the Shrines podcast series. We wish you all the best for the festive season, and we look forward to bringing you a new range of interesting talks and discussions in 2019. Thank you.